started. Is it 2 o'clock? Yes, it is.
Yep. Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the afternoon session for the November 19th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll?
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Okay, we have one item on the calendar. Would you read that, please?
Item 1211, amend accessory short-term rental rentals regulations to allow multi-dwelling structures, multi-dwelling development, triplexes, attached duplexes, manufactured dwellings, and houseboats.
Thanks very much. Oops, sorry.
Establish fee for accessory short-term rental permits in multi-dwelling structures.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for being here. This is the second phase of our work on this issue. As you recall, we dealt with the single-family portion of these zoning code amendments some time ago. I described that as door number one, if you will, in this process of revising our zoning code to deal with the new realities of the sharing economy. We need to play our appropriate role in that economy of making that there's safety and fairness and opportunity. And the proposal in front of us represents some compromises based on the summer hearings and on the discussion since about health and safety and affordability and an appropriate level of control by owners of buildings and homeowner associations. So the short-term rental phenomenon, of course, is here. It's here in both single-family homes and in multifamily dwellings, and our goal is to create a system that works for everyone and isn't onerous. We've had this proposal out in public for about 30 days. It's the result of a lot of collaborative work between my staff, Planning and Sustainability Bureau staff, and community members. So we have a presentation here to take us through the specifics of that by a combination of Jackie Dingfelder and Matthew Robinson from my office and Sandra Wood from Planning and Sustainability Bureau. So thank you all, and let's go through the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and commission members. And I'm going to start off and then hand it over to Matthew, and then we'll walk you through the proposed amendments, the ordinance, and then we'll talk a little bit about how we got to where we are today. Then you'll hear public testimony and hopefully pass this to the second reading on December 3rd. So as you recall, as the mayor stated, the first part of the short-term rental ordinance was adopted. And during that discussion, the issue around multifamily units came up and what and how would those be included in our zoning code if we were going to do short-term rentals. We heard a lot of issues. We heard a lot of questions coming from the commissioners from the community. And so in order to address those in the development of the ordinance, we pulled together some working groups to try to make sure that we're addressing the issues that we heard prior to having this public hearing. So we've been actually discussing these issues for many months with a number of participants. And as you can see on your slide, some of the folks that we'd heard from during the original hearing came forward and said, we have some issues, we'd like to discuss those. So we held three work groups with Multifamily Northwest was at the table, the Community Alliance of Tenants, the Oregon Opportunity Network, Airbnb, commissioner staff, and I'd like to thank all the commissioners for making sure that your staff was involved in all the different bureaus that spent many hours in helping craft the proposal that you see before you today. So we're going to walk through some of the issues that were discussed and the results of those issues you'll see in the proposal before you. And then we're going to walk through some of the other issues that came up. I know we have a series of amendments that I'm assuming the proponents will be discussing. And then we have Bureau staff here if there's any questions that come up in addition to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So with that, I will hand off to Matthew Robinson from the Mayor's staff, who's going to walk through the issues that were discussed and see if there's any questions after that before we hand off to Sandra Wood to walk through the proposed ordinance.
Thank you, Jackie. Matthew Robinson, Mayor's Office, Commissioners.
First, as Jackie mentioned, we put together a working group following the single family hearing, and thank you to the stakeholders who participated in that. We were able to vet a lot of the issues that were discussed during the hearing, as well as several issues that came up since. And as you are aware, there are a number of several unique issues that relate to multi-dwelling units that did not necessarily relate to single family. The slide that you have in front of you represents some of the issues that we explored: authorization, notification, inspections, etc. And you can take a look at the rest of the list to see some of the topics that we explored and some of the things that we discussed during our work group meetings. Now, our goal in this meeting was to vet some of these issues. We wanted to consider them, talk through them, highlight and identify any unique challenges, and also just gather information and look through the lens of what does the city have the authority to regulate, because obviously there are a number of issues, but the city has authority to only regulate a limited number of those. And we think that we did a good job in terms of, in the proposal that you have before you, addressing all the issues that were raised by the stakeholders in those meetings and feel comfortable with what we're bringing forward. So at this point, we are prepared as the mayor's office to, thank you, to make the recommendation to amend Title 33, Planning and Zoning, to allow both Type A and Type B accessory short-term rentals in multi-dwelling units. Sandra momentarily is going to be providing some of the details and some of the specifics in that proposal. But before we do that, just to get some context and see what portion was covered in the summer amendment and what's going to be covered today, we're going to take a look at some of the numbers. And by the numbers that are in front of you, you can see where we have 600,000 residents, roughly 600,000 residents in the city, about 250,000 dwelling units, and the breakdown between single family, which we already dealt with this past summer, covers the vast majority of that, 66%. This is the other 34% that we're dealing with today, the multi-dwelling. And with that, I'll hand it over to Sandra Wood, who's going to go through and give you any specifics. And if there are any questions about how the group came down with some of the different issues that we identified, then Jackie, I'd be happy to take a shot at answering that.
Great. Thank you. Sandra.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. Sandra Wood with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. The specifics that I'll be walking through, of course, are in the mayor's recommended draft, which was published October 30th, 2014. We sent out our public notice on October 21st, and that went out to over 650 people. I just wanted to point out right before page one is a table, and we have extra copies for members of the public back there. And that's what I'll be walking through, the 10 elements of the proposal. I'll have PowerPoint slides for them, but you can follow along on paper to see in case you want to compare it to how is different or the same as a single dwelling. So moving right along, the first thing I wanted to share is something that you've seen before. If you take a look at this slide, it describes the different types of rentals in the city. We talked about this when we were doing the single dwelling this summer. There's long-term rentals for residential rentals, which are more than 30 days. Again, we're not talking about that in this proposal. Short-term rentals that are less than 30 days is the topic at hand today. Of the short-term rentals, there are three categories: the traditional hotels and motels. This amendment does not affect those structure types. And for the other two categories under short-term, we have divided those and made a distinction between the accessory short-term rentals, which takes place in the operator's primary residence. We talked about this a lot during the summer. And that's not changing for the multi-dwelling proposal. So it's still accessory short-term rentals operate within the operator's primary residence. And then there's vacation rentals, which is a rental unit that's not being occupied by a primary resident at all. This proposal does not change the prohibition on those. For accessory short-term rentals, in the summer, we divided them between type A, which were the small ones, where you're renting out one or two of your bedrooms in the dwelling unit, and the type B, which is 3 to 5 bedrooms. So I just wanted to remind you of that. And then walk you through the 10 elements of the proposal today. Really, 7 through 10 is no different from single dwellings, so I don't want to really get into those. So we'll talk really about 1 through 6 on this list. So moving right along, accessory use, the same as what you already adopted this summer, which is to allow accessory short-term rentals as accessory to existing residential use. That means the individual or family who operate the accessory short-term rental must occupy the unit for at least 9 months out of the year.
Yes. What exactly does occupy purposes of this code?
It's the same as the discussions we had in the summer, so there's no amendment to that proposal. Occupy means that you have your driver's license or your Oregon identification and showing that you have said that that's your home, basically. And what council discussed this summer was 9 months out of the year, you would be certifying that you live there, you spend the night there, that's where your belongings are for at least 9 months out of the year. The second element is building types. This proposal expands it from just single dwelling units to all building types. The third element is to add a cap of limiting the number of accessory short-term rentals to one in a building or up to 10% of the units in the multi-dwelling buildings. And you can see how the math works there. Multi-dwelling, for purposes of building code and the zoning code, is three units or more. So 3 to 19 units, people would be allowed to have one accessory short-term rental in that building. 20 to 29 units is two. 30 to 39 units is three, and so on. The bedroom requirements. What we learned when we were exploring this was, what will the inspections look like? Remember, in the single dwelling, BDS is verifying through a BDS inspector going out on site and inspecting the bedrooms. What we found out was that Portland Fire and Rescue already conducts inspections for multi-dwelling buildings, and they do that every 2 years. What they're inspecting is the common areas. They're not going into each dwelling unit. So the proposal is that Portland Fire and Rescue continue with that inspection. Therefore, BDS doesn't need to go out there, but that the residents certify that there are interconnected smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors in each of the units, in each of the bedrooms, that they will be renting as part of this program. The fifth provision is, it's still the Type 8 permit process, but it's for multi-dwelling units. The owner and homeowners association would have to sign the application form, and those signatures would need to be notarized. Renewal every 2 years, the same as a single dwelling. The fee is $100 versus, I think it's $180 now, because BDS needs to send out an inspection, and that's already covered by the Fire Bureau. And again, it could be revoked for failure to comply with the regulations, which is already on the books as of this summer. The sixth provision is the required notice. As you recall, for single dwelling, the resident or the person who wants to, the resident and the operator sends notice or delivers notice to abutting property owners. This proposal, we needed to translate that into a multi-dwelling situation. And where we landed was that the resident sends a notice to the property manager, if there is one, the residents and owners of units adjacent to, across the hall, above and below the unit, and all ONI recognized organizations like the single dwelling. And as I said, the 7 through 10 is no different from single dwelling. There's no amendments proposed to that. The permit number must be posted on all advertising and in the unit. Number of guests is the same as household. Home occupations would still not be allowed, and non-resident employees are not allowed.
Can you go back for a second? The permit number must be posted in all advertisements.
Yes.
Does that mean that it must be contained in any advertisement that any short-term rental company places out there for public view?
Yes, that was our intent. So that's not in the zoning code, but it was in the ordinance that council adopted in July. So you should see that on websites, on Craigslist. If you see it in the newspaper, short-term rental available, it should include the advertising, permit number.
So what happens in a situation that some third party knowingly advertises a unit that doesn't have a permit number?
Nothing.
Well, actually, we have the Bureau of Revenue here available after the presentation if you want to have them come up to discuss that, because we've had discussions about it. So in the zoning code, it doesn't speak to that, but the Bureau of Revenue is looking at options for how to work, to make sure that the permit numbers are actually displayed. And so we have some folks who can come up and talk about that.
So another paraphrase that, there's no zoning code enforcement mechanism for that, but there might be other options.
Correct.
Correct.
And displaying the permit number is considered one of the parts that has to be represented in terms of staying compliant. So if you have a permit but you're not advertising or displaying the permit number on the advertisement, then you're going to be considered out of compliance. For those who don't have a permit number and don't have it, they're already out of compliance.
And by extension, if revenue or anyone else were to check a third-party provider's website to see what units are available in Portland, and there are units listed that don't have a permit number, then there's a problem. I don't know whose problem, but it's either the third-party provider or the operator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then some there's some mechanism for enforcing that. So we'll save on that. We'll bring Thomas up for that one.
And I should have mentioned, I'm sorry I didn't mention this before, but we do have several of our Bureau partners working with us on this, and they're here in the audience. It's Bureau of Development Services, the Revenue Bureau, and also the Fire Marshal, in case we have questions after the testimony. So those are the provisions that are really the bulk of the proposal. Once we put together the proposal for multi-dwelling, we needed to look back at single-dwelling provisions to see if anything changed. And there were three changes that we thought were worth mentioning today, so that you're aware of them. The first one for the single-dwelling units is that when we expanded the building types to multi-dwelling and we allowed, remember the long list of house, attached house, duplex, da-da-da-da-da-da, the only two that were left out was houseboats and single-dwelling units and multi-dwelling development. That last one is where you have, and I think, Commissioner Fish, you had been bringing this up the previous conversation, where you have things that look like townhouses, but they're all on one site. So they're reviewed under the single-dwelling code, but they are all on one site, so they're really multi-dwelling development. Those two types of buildings were falling between the cracks. So when we say we want to expand this to all building types, we indeed mean all building types, including houseboats and those single-dwelling units on one lot. The other one was, because with the multi-dwelling, we are requiring notarized signatures of a variety of people on the application form, the resident, the operator, the property owner, and the homeowners association, we went ahead and duplicated that for the single dwelling just for code consistency, and it's easier to explain to the public and we can all be on the same page with what a signature requires. The final one was, because there are so many renters in a multi-dwelling situation, and part of the value of sending notice to property to abutting neighbors is so they know what the activity is and they know who to contact. In multi-dwelling, we wanted to definitely for people to send out the notice to the residents, not just the property owners if they're in a condo. So we are expanding that in the single dwelling so that residents, not just property owners, know of the activity and receive the notification. The final piece of the proposal is Directive E in the ordinance, which is to amend BDS's fee and penalty schedule by adding a $100 fee for this permit. Just It's in the ordinance. It's the last page of the ordinance, Directive E, which asks you to adopt a special fee for this permit type. I just wanted to make sure you knew about that.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Questions for staff on that summary? And then we might want to keep you here for a moment because I think there's some proposals for amendments from council members. So, Commissioner Fritz, would you like to start?
Sure, thank you. And I very much appreciate all the work that's gone in this, both within the staff and in the community. Lots of really good input in trying to see how we can make this work for property owners, for renters, and for the wider community. So the first question that I've been looking at is about the cap on short-term rentals. And it's a little different in multifamily units, because as we know, most or many multifamily units are either studios or single bedrooms. The reason I know that is because council is often asked to provide incentives to builders to provide larger units. So it's different from a single family home where there's more likely to be more than one bedroom. And so the cap of 10% means that not only is there 10% of the available apartments, but then the occupancy comes into play, that 270 days of the year, most likely the renter, the primary renter, is going to be there. It's unlikely that a guest would be there, be on the couch, or that the primary owner, renter would be on the couch, that most likely the renters would be renting their, opening their home to guests if they were going to be out of town. So for that reason, the numbers work out better if we make the cap 25%. That means that about 6% of a building would be guest occupied over at any one time, and it would mean that it makes the other table more reasonable. That we, in the current proposal, it's already said that triplexes and other units of less than 10 could have at least one unit, which is over the 10% cap. So if we were to set the cap at 25 units in exchange for getting
25%, you mean, yeah.
25%, thank you. In exchange for getting some survey data, that would make more sense. And that's what my amendment number one proposes, is to change 33207040A4 cap to having the cap being limited to one unit or 25% of the local, of the total number of units in the structure, whichever is greater. And then setting the table in A4 commensurate with that, noting that the zoning code rounds down fractions for maximums less to the nearest whole number below the number. So it would be from 3 to 7 units, it would be 1, 8 to 11, 2, 12 to 15, 3, and then up to 24, 16 to 19, 24. And so that's the amendment that I'm moving.
So what I'd suggest we do, if that makes sense to the council, is we take each of these amendment proposals. If there's a second, then we'll put it on the table, but not obviously make final decisions about them, so that we can have a public hearing with all the amendments in front of us. So we've got, I think, a total of 4 or 5 proposed amendments. If we can take them sequentially and discuss them, and if there's at least willingness to consider them, take a motion to put those on the table, and then we'll have all of them in front of us and in front of those that want to speak about them this afternoon. That make sense? So I'll take that as a motion, Commissioner Fritz, on your first proposed amendment. Is there a second?
Can I provide one clarification?
Sure,
Commissioner
please.
Fritz, you mentioned that, just because you mentioned the code citation, the cap would apply for both the Type A permit and the Type B. So even if you're doing a conditional use for the Type B permit, the cap.
You're so helpful. Thank you very much. Yes, that was my intent.
Mayor, do you want, now that it's been offered and second, is this the time to have a council discussion, or do you want testimony
yes.
and then council discussion?
Well, I think any questions or discussion about what's on the table would be perfectly appropriate right now, and then again, we'll give people a chance to react to it when they speak. So,
good. So I have a couple of questions, and I just want to better understand the approach. Under a 25% cap, if there are 100 units in the building, how many units would be eligible for short-term rentals?
25.
Okay. And one of the examples that we looked at on the cap was Austin, Texas. And they're at 3%, I think, both on residential and multifamily. Did in your research, any of the three panelists, did you find other examples from other cities of caps and rationales for caps?
No, I didn't. We didn't.
Is that because we're ahead of the curve in regulating, or?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, I think in general, when we started looking into this, most jurisdictions have zoning codes where our traditional residential land is for residential uses, and then they have a whole bunch of exceptions. Some of them had had bed and breakfast regulations adopted in the 80s, very much like we did. Most of those go through conditional uses. So Ashland, for example, has toyed with their conditional use thresholds, but they have really for multi-dwelling zones is how they approached it. Austin was the only one that we found that had the 3%. And they had 3% in single dwelling maximum for the census tract. And then they applied that same number to multi-dwelling.
If I might just clarify in response to your previous question, Commissioner Fish, if it's 25 units out of the 100, each of those 25 can only rent out 25% of the time if they're single, if they're one-bedroom or studios, because they require to be owner-occupied for 270 days of the year.
So the second question I have is, in one of our earlier hearings, there was some discussion, maybe confusion, about what state law mandated or didn't mandate in this area, and if you got above a certain threshold, it might trigger code requirements that impact the building. So the building has to be at a higher level of life safety above a certain threshold. Where do we stand on what's our understanding of state law and how it impacts this decision?
We have BDS staff here if you'd like to.
We can actually invite BDS staff up now if you'd like to discuss that.
Come on up.
Hello, good afternoon. Mike Liefeld, BDS. So we did have a lengthy discussion separate from the zoning code amendments, which related to the building code and the change of occupancy that may or may not be required going from an R2 apartment dwelling to an R1, which is a building code occupancy for transient use, less than 30 days, hotels, motels. Our previous determinations indicated that a change of use would be required for adding short-term rentals. We have further, that determination was made prior to council adopting the limit of or the requirement that the resident occupy the unit for 270 days. And so we have gone back to the state of Oregon, asked them based on what has already been adopted, and talked about some potential caps that were going to be explored if they felt they could support our decision not to require a change of occupancy under those thresholds, and they have agreed with that interpretation. So based on the proposal for a 25% cap in multi-family structures, a change of occupancy would not be required in those units.
In layman's terms, what's the significance? What's the significance of having a occupant for 270 days to the state's concern about life safety issues?
Well, I think it really gets to how they categorize the difference between a R2, which is a non-transient, where the occupant predominantly occupies the unit for more than 30 days, and a transient use, where the occupant predominantly does not occupy the unit for 30 days. And I think the idea before, when we interpreted the building code, asked the state for clarifications, council had not adopted that requirement, so it was wide open. There was no requirement that a resident had to be there for any amount of time during a calendar year. And so we were looking at it as a proposal for unlimited nightly rentals without a requirement that the resident occupy the space for any given time.
And do we now have an official ruling from the state, or is this in the nature of an advisory opinion?
We have only recently made contact with them today, and it was, I guess, in the form of an advisory. It was a verbal advisory, but we have checked in with them. So BDS feels this is good information to go on.
They've deferred to us. Paul Scarlett, BDS director. So, yes, the state has deferred to us as the city of Portland, the jurisdiction to administer review and possibly go in this direction. And in connection with what Mike has said, it's deemed ancillary in that the predominant time that someone would be spending in such units would be by the renter. So the someone who's looking at a short-term rental situation would be somewhat subsequent. So it's not looked at as a primary, more ancillary, and to that determination, feel there's enough safeguard in place. So that those were some of the conversations with the state.
So, Paul, if we're satisfied that the state doesn't have an issue, because that was hanging out there, so we needed to make sure it didn't trigger a change in use. I guess my final question is, at what point does this allowed activity fundamentally changed the character of a multifamily property. Most people who rent in multifamily do so because they're long-term renters, it's their primary residence, and they have an expectation of a certain level of privacy, safety, community. If up to 25% of the units can be rented out for short-term rentals, it strikes me at some point it's beginning to change the character of the building, putting aside whether it's sanctioned by the owner, the homeowners association, or the landlord. Do you have any guidance for us on where that balance is?
I do believe some of that will be a factor of the market, and as you mentioned, maybe the landlords and the owners as to whether they would allow. Certainly this is new, and there will be some monitoring to see how many folks would take advantage of those opportunities or provisions. It's still being utilized as a multifamily dwelling apartment. People are staying there, whether it's 29 days or 60 days. So I don't know that the dynamics would change that much. There might be concerns around, you know, folks who you don't know, but the notification process and some of those things hopefully will help manage some of those concerns.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, issues to raise with staff? So if we're ready, I think we should take a roll call on putting this amendment on the table, just so we know whether we want to keep considering it as we take testimony. So let's do that, please.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
You know, I have a lot of concerns about this approach, and I realize we're operating in something of a vacuum, but given that this activity broadly is not allowed under the terms of most leases, given that this is going to have a significant impact on tenants and the expectations they have, and given that we're sort of, in fairness, making this up, I'm still not persuaded that a 25% cap is the right mix, although Commissioner Fritz and her staff have done a very thoughtful job in crafting this. So I'm going to demur for now and then listen to the testimony. No.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Hales.
Aye. Okay. So that one's on the table. Let's take the next one, which I think you have ready, Commissioner Fritz.
Actually, I'd like to defer to Commissioner Fish because he's got a fire smoke detector amendment, which I think belongs properly before the one that I have.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Fish, you ready with your amendment?
A few of these smoke detectors went off last night at a forum that Commissioner Fritz and I
attended. Just a reminder that they work, huh?
So you have the amendment that we've drafted would require the property owner or the property manager to self-certify that the bedrooms to be rented have the required smoke detectors and carbon monoxide alarms rather than the renter.
Okay, so this is requiring that the person that verifies that exists is the owner or the property manager, because in some cases they're owner managed and in other cases there's a property management company involved and so
on. We like the idea of self-certification, but we want to make sure that the person doing the self-certification has some kind of expertise and some kind of stake in making sure that this is done properly.
Okay. Questions, concerns about this one? Then a roll call vote to put that on the table.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay. And now your next amendment, Commissioner Fritz.
Good catch, Commissioner Fish. So my next amendment is to clarify the smoke detector language as to the location of the interconnected system with an adjacent hallway, which is within the unit. And this is 33207040B4B. And I'm not sure if I'm supposed to have another section as well, but if so, I'm sure Sandra will carry it over into the other section. And that is to say, it currently says has a smoke detector that is interconnected with a smoke detector in an adjacent hallway. Add that is in the adjacent unit. So the point is that the smoke detector needs to be in the unit, not necessarily in the hallway.
But it's interconnected with the hallway.
Right.
Okay. That just goes into the code. That's again required, and the property owner is going to be representing that's the case when they file the application.
Right, and my understanding is that most rental agreements, the tenant certifies that they're not going to disconnect the smoke detectors, remove the batteries, et cetera.
So Mr. Fritz, is this 040B4B or 040 Airbnb?
No.
I'm sorry, I was trying to read my...
I'll rule that out of order.
And it's only Wednesday.
Texas is small, I can't...
All right, it's too early to be punchy.
Commissioner?
a smoke detector that is interconnected with a smoke detector in an adjacent hallway that is in the dwelling unit. That phrasing it occurs to me kind of makes it seem like it's the hallway that's in the dwelling unit. Maybe there's some punctuation or something we could use to clarify.
Yeah, I think actually that needs to go into a different point in a sentence.
Right.
Perhaps Senator can help us with that clarification.
So the sense of this is there's a smoke detector in the unit. This is requiring that it is interconnected with the one that's in the common hallway shared by that unit and others, right?
How about just moving the phrase after the first detector? Have a smoke detector that is in the dwelling unit and that is interconnected with the smoke detector in the hallway.
Thank you.
Okay.
So moved.
All right, I'll take that as a motion. Is
Mr. Mayor,
second?
Mr. Mayor, we have a clarification.
We have staff to assist here.
Yes.
So just to clarify, the intent here is to ensure that if there is an apartment unit with one bedroom, two bedrooms, and a hallway within that unit, that's where the smoke detectors need to be interconnected. It's early detection. This clarification, as originally written, was, I think there was confusion that the language in the single-family zones was indicating that they had to be interconnected with the hallways of the apartment building, and this is still solely within
the unit.
It's just, so those apartment buildings already have their own detection systems. We're not asking for
upgrades. And there may be a hallway within the unit.
Correct. Yes.
Building code would already require that, then. Building code would require that there's a smoke detector in the hallway and that there's one in each bedroom?
Correct. Well, new code would, but this would be an upgrade for older buildings.
My apologies. Yes.
Unamended.
All right. So as written.
As written.
Do we have to move to?
No. So I'll assume we're taking a roll call on putting that on the table as amended. Again, if we have language issues that we need to work out, we will. But I think we now understand what the language in front of us means. Any further questions? Let's take a roll call on that.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales.
Aye, thank you. Okay, next.
Thank you, Mayor. The next one is regarding having the property owner or property manager to sign the application.
Originally it was just owner?
Originally it was the property owner, but sometimes it's the property manager who's in charge. The owner may be in Timbuktu or wherever. And so having the property owner or the property manager in Section 33-207-040C2-3 it wherever else it needs to be.
Okay. Clear to me. Questions?
Actually, Commissioner, I'm probably behind the times, but I remember hearing at some point that there's an issue as to LLCs, as to who is the authorized signature. Is that something that's not really an issue? And by saying property owner, that takes care of the LLCs?
I believe so.
Okay.
And in that case, I would think it probably would be a property manager. Certainly, we're going to get expert testimony from our community folks who are here about that.
Okay.
Just a question on notarization, for if anyone knows. Does a person who puts in a notarized statement where the signature is not authentic in some way, so you've violated, there's a violation of the notary provision, does that give rise to a separate enforcement action independent of whether there's been code compliance? Is there a sanction for having someone falsely notarize for purposes of our oversight? Or does it just make it a defective application?
I think it would. We'd probably first just rescind the approval and basically state that the permit was issued in error.
So someone who comes to you
false,
and says,
right,
"I, Charlie Hales, did not sign this authorization," so you got a problem.
That's not
grounds
a complete
for rescinding,
application.
Right? But it might also be grounds to go after the notary. If the notary public notarized his signature.
We also have our city attorney here who.
Okay, but it's grounds for rescinding if it turns out that it's.
I mean, I guess what the question would be, I mean, a notary is simply saying that the person who's sitting there in front of them is the person who's signing it. So they're not going to, a notary is not going to be verifying that the person signing has authority on behalf of an LLC or actually is the property owner. So I don't think there's probably a sanctionable offense against the notary in that case. I think, as Mike said, it would be whether or not they're able to keep their permit.
Yeah. Our issue is, did we issue a permit to somebody who was authorized to ask for one? Okay.
Right.
Okay, clear enough. So a roll call on putting that amendment into the package or on the table.
And who seconded?
Steve, did you second that?
Yes.
Yes, you did.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales.
Aye. Okay, and I think we have one more.
Yes, thank you. My final amendment is on the same section, and this is regarding homeowners associations. The city doesn't generally get into the private relationship between property owners and homeowners association. There's all kinds of archaic and other CCNRs that the city doesn't get into enforcing. And so I'm proposing to take out the requirement to have the homeowners association sign off on this. It would be very difficult. That would be even more difficult for a notary or somebody else to figure out, was this the appropriate signatory to be signing on behalf of the homeowners association. So I'm proposing that we delete that requirement.
So in a okay.
So go ahead. Is there a
let's
second
get a second first.
Second that. So go ahead.
So Commissioner Fritz, the homeowners association would typically arise in a condominium, is that correct?
My understanding.
And in a condominium, while you own your individual unit, they are heavily prescribed in terms of what you can do outside of your unit in the common areas. So is there a risk in eliminating the homeowners association that you're taking out the party that may be best suited to know whether, strictly speaking, this is an allowable activity?
It would still be the notification requirements. I mean, we don't enforce, homeowners associations say that you can't paint your unit particular colors or you can't have flags outside the window. We don't get involved in enforcing that. There's already mechanisms for the homeowners association to self-police. So I don't think that there is that risk, and I really would prefer not to have BDS be in the position of trying to adjudicate who's authorized to sign for the homeowners association.
Did we get any testimony either way on this subject through your work groups? Was this an issue that came up one way or another?
Homeowners Association.
No, no, for condominiums.
No, for condominiums. Well, it's a single dwelling within a condominium context.
I think the main issue that Matthew Robinson, Mayor's office, I think the main issue that came up was around authorization for coming in and applying for the permit, and that mainly that the discussion that we had was mainly around property owners and building owners. It did not generally cover homeowners associations. And as the mayor and Commissioner Fritz have said, the homeowners association, they have their own remedy rights that they can pursue if they feel as though there's a violation of the HOA.
Right. So by removing this, who has to sign the form, just so I'm clear?
In a condo.
The resident, the operator, and the property owner.
And the operator is the?
Property manager, if the one exists.
There is one, right. Okay. Not in the case of a condo, right?
No, the operator, remember last time you approved that a resident could hire a private property management company to come in and manage their rental units.
Right.
So the operator would be that company.
Or the daughter basically. Can do it for mom.
Or the daughter or the whatever.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, that makes sense.
So thank you.
I'm sorry, maybe it's just time of the day. The resident and the property owner in a condo context could be one and the same.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The operator would be his or her designee.
Right. There could be just one person.
Right. So that's the owner of the unit. So we're treating the owner of the unit in a condo like the owner of a unit in a single family.
Correct.
And whatever kerfluffle there is with the homeowners association is a separate matter that they need to enforce.
Correct.
Through the homeowners.
That's your intent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, everybody clear on that? The intent of that? So then a roll call to put that amendment on the table.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay, I think unless there are any other amendments I hadn't heard about, that we put those in front of us here so that people can respond to those proposed amendments as well as to the rest of the package.
Paul, could you stay here for one sec before we lose you? Because one of the questions that is probably going to come up in the course of the testimony is what's been our current compliance rate with people filing under the single family? What, if any, lessons do you derive from that compliance rate?
Well, certainly the effort that went into it was great, and we did get a code adopted. But since, is it September 1st, I believe, the count is probably less than 30 permits it's been applied for. And, you know, that's pretty small relative to the number advertised. So we're still administering the code and our program relative to what comes to us in form of request for permit. And if we get complaints on, I guess, residents that have these situations, we will respond to those, but we're not proactively initiating enforcement activities about anything that we don't know about.
What's your guesstimate? 30 is your is what percentage of the universe of single-family rentals?
Well, it's I believe the figure I saw was 1,600. I don't know the breakdown between single-family and residential, but 30 of 1,600, I don't know what percentage that is. It's pretty small. Two?
And just to be clear, that is both the 1,600 is single and multifamily, so
yeah, I don't know the breakdown. Right, yeah.
One of the things we'll be thinking about is at what point in the process do we come back and evaluate certain things, evaluate compliance rates, evaluate enforcement, evaluate impact on affordable housing stock. What is your sense of a reasonable ramp-up time to get people to comply with that requirement?
That's a good question. I really don't have a good answer. This is so new in terms of, I guess, trying to implement a code to catch up with a practice or activity that's been ongoing for a number of years. And so I don't know the ratio of how long it would take to for people with all the outreach and the advertisement we did around the adoption of the new code. You would think there would be a higher percentage of application being sought or submitted at this point, but I really don't have an idea how long it might take.
Thomas Lanham gives us predictions about compliance with taxes and fees, and he gives us sort of, you know, projections, and then we come back and we ask, what do we have to do to bump up the number? Do we need some kind of North Star to shoot for over the next 6 months so that we have some basis to come back and assess, or do we need to keep that open, in your judgment?
I imagine we keep that open unless we're going to change our policy about how we pursue enforcement activities. That's one trigger. Could increase the activity or the permit, you know, application numbers. But short of that, I think we're looking at the mark and see what's happening. The code is in place. It's allowed. You have to, of course, get the permit to legalize the unit.
In the context I'd put that into, but it'd be good to hear from the community about this as well, is that, you know, we rely on complaints to enforce a lot of things in the zoning code. We don't have, in a zoning code, we do have code compliance. I'll get back to that, code compliance inspectors. But we aren't out proactively looking for zoning code violations. We wait for complaints about that. An analogy that I might use as police commissioner is, you know, compliance with the law is an individual choice, and where we direct our enforcement efforts is a city choice. So it is currently illegal to operate a motor vehicle while talking or texting. It's an individual choice to comply with that law. For us, we could decide to say, Portland Police Bureau, we want you to go out and really start enforcing that particular law. It's a similar situation here. How important is compliance with this particular law? Don't confess guilt right here.
I'm saying yes. Please go out and enforce that law.
He's not allowed to applaud. He was doing that.
He wants us to do
that.
Yes, we know Commissioner Salzman wants us to do that. So it's the same thing here. Do we think this is a big enough problem that we would want to start ramping up enforcement down the line? I don't know. It's a fair
So
problem.
I guess, and I think that's... Follow the logic of that, and I guess the question I would have before this proceeding's over is, what level of non-compliance would trigger us in 6 months or a year to say there's something structurally wrong with what we've adopted? Right. Just like if we learn that, you know, 3/4 of the restaurants weren't getting licenses for, you know, serving food or whatever, at what point would we say there's probably a structural problem in how we're going about it?
Yes.
And not rely just on the fact it's a complaint-driven system, and we know there's you know, widespread failure to comply, but so be it.
The other thing that a little time might give us is, again, some comparison with what's being done in other cities. We're one of the first cities to deal with the sharing economy in this format. We're also dealing with the questions of the sharing economy in the taxicab regulation system. In both cases, if the municipality fails to act, the sharing economy might simply get around us, as it's already the case with short-term rentals. There are already thousands of people participating in these systems in Portland without the benefit of being able to do it legally. So we'll be able to see how that's working out in Austin and San Francisco and some other cities while we're seeing how our own code is working in practice.
And let me be clear, I'm probably in the camp that's less concerned about the revenue generation for the city.
Right.
I mean, that's nice. In fact, as you know, I'd like to divert that money to another purpose. I'm more concerned about the health and safety of the person who is the guest, because we are, in effect, by legalizing this, saying to the public that there's an expectation of a certain baseline of health and safety. And if we know there's wholesale noncompliance, and therefore the greater likelihood of a unit that's not safe, at some point that's going to have a human consequence, and then we'll have to account for it. So that's how I look at it, not in trying to shut down an otherwise laudable activity.
Yeah,
one of the things, by putting the requirements, have the permit number posted, if we educate the buying public, they are then going to be looking for the ones that have the permits. But if we were to dedicate more general fund money to enforcement in development services, I would not choose to put it towards short-term rentals. It would be more in distressed properties and enhanced inspections in East Portland.
Yep. In fact, we just did.
Yeah, but
and yet we need more.
No.
And okay. Mr. Mayor and Commissioner Fish, I want to make sure that the question that we deferred for revenue gets addressed, and that's why Thomas is up here.
So I'm Thomas Lanham, the Revenue Division Director in the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services. To answer your question, from a tax perspective, we don't take a complaint-driven approach toward enforcement. We do actively try to enforce the tax code. It's very important for a range of reasons I probably don't need to list. So as part of that enforcement, it is our intent to provide BDS with information as we have it in terms of host locations and that sort of thing. Mm. So the compliance rate right now is probably closer to 1%. The 1,600 locations, that's just Airbnb, and they may be in the ballpark of half the market. So the rest of the platforms that are offering locations are totally out there in the black right now, or mostly in the black. So the approach basically around enforcement is to take a look at whether or not we should be amending the city code to require platforms that are advertising locations to provide us with host locations, host names, agents, that sort of thing.
And the reason we're not taking that up now is that they have said they are not inclined to give us that information?
So we did send a letter in September requesting that information be voluntarily tendered, and those that replied that they would not or did not want to provide that information.
So it seems to me that there's a strong signal from this council that we expect people to follow the law now that the council is contemplating making it legal. And if at some point the compliance rate remains in the dismal single digits, we may have to take other action, including requiring that the information be furnished to us by these third parties. But that would require a code change.
That's correct, and I'll take it a step further. I intend to recommend exactly that step to council in the next few weeks.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. Other questions for staff? All right. Thank you. I'm sure we'll have more later. So let's open the hearing and take public testimony. How many people do we have signed up?
We have 28 people signed up.
Okay. All right.
The first three, please come on up, are Ben Pickering, Melissa Valaro, and Mark Nelson. And they'll be followed by Lois Cantor, I believe it's Teresa Nelson, and David Owen.
So we're going to ask, because of the number of people, that you try to limit your testimony to 2 minutes, if you could, please. That will give everyone here a chance to have their say.
Is Mark Nelson? Okay, let's go ahead and go with Lois Cantor. Or Lewis, sorry.
Okay. Go ahead, please. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Melissa Valano.
Just push the button on the base of that. There you go.
Hello? My name is Melissa Valano. I'm a branch organizer at Portland Socialist Alternative, as well as a resident of Northeast Portland. We at Portland Socialist Alternative strongly oppose the amendment introduced by Mayor Hales. Allowing the owners of multifamily dwellings and condos to rent their property on a short-term basis will lead to a housing shortage for Portland residents. As the supply of affordable long-term housing decreases due to Airbnb, the cost of renting an apartment, condo, or home will rise, pricing out working-class people and leading to a decrease in the quality of life for permanent residents. We've seen the damage Airbnb has inflicted in San Francisco and New York City. Both cities, despite being popular tourist destinations, have seen their housing crisis worsen as a result of laws allowing Airbnb. Commissioner Fish has brought up questions about how this has affected other cities. I would point you to a lawsuit by the rental corporation called HomeAway Incorporated. They've sued the city of San Francisco on the grounds for an injunction on the grounds that the laws permitting Airbnb are discriminatory. You can find it on Google. The San Francisco Chronicle has written extensively about it. It's a very important factor to consider. In San Francisco, hotel unions, housing advocates, neighborhood associations, and even Senator Dianne Feinstein have all echoed the concerns that Airbnb is leading to a long-term housing crisis and a decrease in the quality of life for working-class people. Mayor Hales continues to refer to Airbnb as a forerunner to a sharing economy. But what does sharing economy even mean? Sharing implies an equal distribution of goods. Sharing means the interest of the many is held in higher regard than the needs of the wealthy few. To imply a connection between Airbnb and long-term sustainability in the public interest is further indication that Mayor Hales is playing lip service to the needs of the working-class people in Portland. What does it say about the priorities of our city government that instead of meeting the long-term housing needs of the citizens, the city is seeking to accommodate the short-term needs of those who have no stake in Portland's communities or future at all? We at Portland Socialist Alternative recognize the allure of providing short-term housing options for travelers, and we agree that it's necessary. But those options should not come at the expense of present and future generations of working-class Portlanders. A better solution is the owner-occupier-only rule, ensuring the building owner lives on site for all but 12 days a year. The ordinance, as it's currently written, is not in the interest of working-class people. Housing our citizens should be a bigger priority and housing short-term visitors. Portland Socialist Alternative would also like to remind the council that there is no tourism industry in this city without working-class people. Talking about the service industry people, we're talking about musicians, we're talking about artists, we're talking about the people whose efforts and labor and talent and creativity make people want to come here in the first place. We demand an ordinance that reflects the needs of the people who built the tourism industry and on whose labor its long-term vitality depends. Thank you.
We think you might have a misunderstanding that was here at the last hearing, too, which is that the resident of the apartment is the one who decides to put their unit into the system.
Well, right?
Not the owner by themselves, but the resident of the apartment says, I want to participate in this, and they have to get the owner's permission.
Correct.
But the owner can't simply say, I want to take 10 of my units and make them short-term rentals. That's not an option that we're opening up with this code change.
But the question is, how long does the owner have to be on site?
The apartment
right.
renter,
like
how often? Three
like you were saying earlier, I don't mean to interrupt, but yeah. You were saying earlier, just so I can be clear, that there is I believe it was 260
days? 270
days
out of the
70
year.
Days. Mm-hmm. Okay,
right.
So that's the issue.
So the resident of that apartment that wants to put their apartment into this system in order to earn extra money
sure.
has to still live in that apartment at least 270 days of the year.
And that's the issue that we're in conflict over.
Well, they,
and that's what we think the problem
okay.
will be.
Okay.
Because if someone's
sure
in for 275 days a year,
right.
that's almost 100 days when they can be away on vacation, out of state, et cetera. And what that will affect, as Commissioner Fish brought up, is the quality of the living situation for the community of people in the building, in the neighborhood, et cetera. If you have people that are on vacation, their priorities are much different than people that live there full time. There's going to be an increase in alcohol abuse or use. There's going to be an increase in potentially drug use. There's going to be the priorities of people that are on vacation are different than the priorities of people that are not.
Okay. Just want to make sure you understood that was the deal.
I do. So, I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. Go ahead.
Lewis Cantor, is this working?
Yes.
Okay. I'm here about safety, and Nick Fish made this very easy for me. There's three bits of information that are out there right now. One, the conformance to existing regulations for single-family dwelling units is already ignored by apparently 99% of the users. Second, Airbnb doesn't verify that the units they broker are licensed. Telephone requests from BDS, as was mentioned, requesting verification has been ignored. If I can make a side remark, such a request should be made in writing by the city attorney. Third, and this gets to self-certifying, and I think the proposed change would help. I was going to suggest that the